host, Dr. Rick Klofein. Always a pleasure to interview authors on our show. This is Temple of Health, brought to you by Plastikos and Millennium Healthcare. Usually I'm on with my co-host, Dr. Susan Kolb, who's our founder and the visionary behind our work and this show. We interview authors that appeal to us professionally and personally. Dr. Kolb and myself are both conventional physicians. She's a plastic and reconstructive surgeon, board certified in gynecology. We're also both holistic physicians and have practiced holistic medicine for many years in Atlanta. Her practice is Plastikos, her holistic medicine, Millennium Healthcare. So the topics that we usually cover have to do with medicine, integrative and complementary medicine, spiritual healing, spiritual vision, metaphysics, consciousness, new science, a lot of different topics, all of which interest us. And when we find a book that particularly appeals to us, then we try to get it on the show. And that's why I have with us today Dr. Gabriel Weiss and his book, Healing Power of Meditation. Now, off the front cover, your prescription for getting well and staying well with meditation. So Dr. Weiss is a practicing internist, practicing for 30 years. He has 10 years on me. I've only been practicing for 20 years in Atlanta. And he's an internist trained at Stanford with two practice locations that we'll ask him about. Also a musician, also a practitioner of Zen meditation for many years. The thing that particularly interested me about Dr. Weiss's book are several things. First of all, in the book, he gives a very good introduction to meditation with instruction that I would feel comfortable giving to anybody in my practice, regardless of who they were, regardless of their religious or religious belief or social setting. And I greatly appreciate that, because it's a book I will be recommending for that reason. Second of all, he documents specific medical conditions that can benefit from the practice of meditation and documents them, goes through them, and gives his perspective and his personal experience, as well as citing specific references to research that helps support that position. Of course, this book is from 2008, so there's lots of work that's been done since this has been published. Are you with us, Dr. Weiss?
Gary? Yes, I am.
Gabriel, this is Rick Klofein.
Rick, thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, thanks for being on. So I'd like to start to get to know you a little bit in your role as physician to help set the context for us moving towards the discussion of meditation and medicine. Can you tell me a little bit about what brought you to become a physician and a little bit about your current practice?
Yes, I am, as you said, a practicing internist who practices general adult medicine. And I began my medical training at Stanford, and it was there that I first learned to practice meditation. And after I learned to practice meditation, I would find it helped me in medical school, because it really helped restore my energy and helped restore me when I've had lack of sleep from being on call for 24 hours in a row. And also I would notice that I would become a little bit more creative with creative new ideas that would come up with meditation. And then when I went into medical practice, I found that meditation was a technique that could help so many of my patients that were coming to me with problems or symptoms that were related to stress or anxiety or depression or problems that were made worse by those problems of stress, anxiety, or depression. So I started recommending simple forms of meditation to those people and found it helped them. And I was really pleased that it not only helped them, but it was something that was free for them to do and had no evident side effects, which was very different from the medication treatments that I would be prescribing for many other conditions. So I thought that was great, and then I personally wanted to see how meditation could be more applied to your daily activities, not just your meditation 15 or 30 minute experience. And so that led me from when I first learned transcendental meditation to more studying Zen meditation, which has a lot to say with how meditation principles and the present oriented state of mind could be brought into your normal daily activities. So that really expanded the application of meditation to so many more things.
I'm interested as to whether you started practicing TM before or after you entered medical school.
I started it just about the same time. I learned it my last year in college, and then when I went to medical schools, you know, I was already knew the basics of how to do transcendental meditation.
Did you always know that you wanted to become a physician? Did you go straight through college and then right into medical school?
Well, I didn't know I wanted to be a doctor at the beginning of college. I actually thought I was going to go into research in either physics or chemistry, but then I found that, and when I did some work study with researchers in those areas, that I didn't want to be stuck in a lab like I saw they were doing most of the time, and I wanted to be more in contact with people and see more of a direct effect on what I was doing to help their lives. So that drew me to the practice of medicine.
I'm interested because I also meditated through medical school. I was a practitioner. I had been initiated into meditation, was a practitioner through medical school. And so I find it, hearing your comments, I find very interesting.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back. Forgive us. We're going to put our caller and guest on a separate line and get the levels just a little more evened out. Thank you for tuning in to BBS Radio. Again, we'll be tuning into some breath.
You had plastic surgery, Bill?
You bet I did. I got tired of the wrinkles around my eyes and decided to have Plasticos do something about them.
But I didn't think men had plastic surgery.
Get with it, Bob. Men want to look their best, too. There's nothing wrong with getting a little help from Plasticos to look on top of your game. A lot of guys are doing it, my friend.
Well, I don't know about this.
Look, you see the difference Plastico's made with me. I look better and I feel better. My Plastico surgery was an investment in me.
So where is Plastico's?
Plastico's is in Dunwoody. Plastico's is staffed by pros who guarantee you personal attention. The Plastico's number is 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available. 770-457-4677.
Don't you just hate trying on bathing suits? Wait a minute, you look great. Plastic surgery?
Not surgery. I got an endermology treatment from the experts at Plastico's.
What's endermology?
Endermology is the terrific non-surgical treatment that Europeans have been using for years to tone skin and contour the body. Endermology by Plastico's feels great, and you can see the difference it makes.
No kidding. Who do I call?
Plastico's, a leader in plastic and reconstructive surgery, is the number one center in Atlanta offering endermology. For more information and a complimentary consultation and treatment, call Plastico's at 770-457-4677. Plastico's Endermology Skin Toning and Body Contouring, 770-457-4677.
We're back with Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Rick Klofheim. We're speaking with Dr. Gabriel Weiss, a practicing internist from California who wrote the book, The Healing Power of Meditation. We were discussing before we had our break. I was bringing up the topic of meditating through medical school, and it was a very personal experience of benefit to me. Now, I find that one of the things about meditation that's so good for people is that they experience benefits pretty rapidly from it. Has that been your experience?
Yeah, some of the benefits come through right away, and other benefits take longer to occur as you practice meditation and learn how to develop your concentration.
You commented that you initially practiced transcendental meditation and then subsequently became a practitioner of Zen meditation, and that correlated with a sort of a sounds like a changing worldview for yourself. Could you comment on that?
Yes, I could see that meditation was of help, practicing a sitting form of meditation, 15 or 20 minutes once or twice a day. But then I began to wonder, how could I bring a state of mind, which I would call a present-oriented state of mind, to my normal daily activities? And because I wanted to, when I was at work or at play, wanted to actually experience some of the qualities of being totally in the moment or in the present and those times too. And that's what led me to expanding my view of how meditation could techniques could accomplish that and be brought into the daily activities.
Now, we're using the term meditation sort of in a global way, but there are different types of meditation that invoke different mind states.
Correct, yes.
You teach several different meditations in the book.
That's right. The book starts with what I would call a fundamental technique, which is simple to learn, easy to do, and that's what I still do most of the time. But in addition to that, I find it useful just based on my mood or what I'm dealing with in terms of different types of stress or suffering to sometimes employ other techniques and other forms of meditation. So they're complementary, and I think it helps to know more than one type depending on how much time you have to meditate or what the situation is or what your mood is.
The practice of meditation is something that when people initiate the practice, that I've always found they need to understand that just like anything else, you get better at it as you do it. And the more persistent application you make in a comfortable way, the better people get at it and the more benefits are derived.
I totally agree with that. And there's research, a lot of neuroscience research is also outlined in my book. And one of the main points from that I'd like to make that relates to what you just said is that we know from neuroscience research that the more you practice something, the greater the amount of brain tissue is devoted to that activity. Your brain has the capacity of what's called neuroplasticity, meaning it can increase the amount of brain tissue devoted to various activities and over time due to creating more neurologic connections or pruning off other neurologic connections and actually even growing new nerve cells we now know is possible in the adult brain. So the more you practice something, anything, including meditation, the more your neural pathways become more easy to trigger that whole process in your brain. So that's why meditation, you can get, as you practice it, you can get into a deeper state quicker. And as you get into the deeper states of meditation, you're more likely to get what I call the benefit of insight. I think without even knowing or practicing it very long, you get most of the benefits just from the practice of it, even if you aren't more than a novice practitioner. But there's the additional deeper benefit of the insight about your life, the insights about what's causing your suffering and how to reduce your suffering, that I do think come a little more easily as you develop concentration through practice of meditation.
So
most of the benefits, the health benefits, occur before you get to that state, right? Really, relatively rapidly, you can begin to develop the health benefits of meditation.
It sounds like a positive self-reinforcing spiral where you're doing the meditation. This brings you insights into a better life, into a clearer life where you're living with a greater discernment about what's good for yourself. And living more frequently in that state literally changes the substrate of our mind so that it's easier to stay in that place and be in that place.
Yes, I actually think meditation is a different state of consciousness. You know, we have the normal state of consciousness of our thinking mind, where most of the time it's either replaying or regretting the past or planning, anticipating, and worrying about the future. But meditation is a way of stopping that constant chatter that goes on in your mind, that normal thinking process, and instead rooting yourself totally in the present, and it's actually a different state of consciousness, therefore.
This state of being in the present. So I was interested in reading your book, and I want to thank you for giving acknowledgement of two books that were very powerful in your life, evidently, or you wouldn't have mentioned them. That were two books that were very powerful very early in my life. That was Be Here Now by Ram Dass and Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda.
Yes.
What we're talking about is Be Here Now.
Yes.
The state of consciousness of Be Here Now, of being present, of not holding on, being depressed about the past, because we're holding on to it, but allowing it to flow downstream where it belongs, not being anxious about the future, because the way to influence the future is by being present. Both of those books were very powerful for me because they sort of helped reinforce experiences that I was having to sort of shake me out of seeing things the way that I, even though I didn't completely understand it, shake me out of seeing things the way I always had and opening my mind to seeing things in new and different ways. And the practice of meditation and other yoga practices I was doing at the time really helped reinforce that. Very powerful, this different state of consciousness. So I appreciate the last part of your book that is comments on topics of consciousness. This is a very fascinating research, and the state of the art is changing very rapidly, as you just described in the new concepts of the plasticity of the mind, and that the neural tissue and the brain tissue is not static, period. And there are a lot of insights coming out of Buddhism, and a lot of the research is in association with Buddhist practitioners around the study of consciousness and what consciousness is and what makes up consciousness. One question I'd like to ask you, after rambling on here for a couple minutes, is I'd like you to comment on the idea whether consciousness is part and parcel and substrate to the human mind, or whether the mind is part of the process, but maybe more like a TV transmits the signal, but the TV itself is not the signal. Without the signal, the TV just sits there blank. What are your feelings about this?
Well, there are people who do research into consciousness actually haven't all yet agreed on a definition of consciousness, which I think is interesting because it varies from researcher or author to author. And after doing a lot of reading about people who've written on the subject, I would say that consciousness is probably succinctly defined as awareness of yourself and your surroundings in a remembered present. This reflects some of the ideas of Edelman, who has done a lot of neurological research in consciousness in La Jolla, and also some of the other authors who have written on consciousness also talk a lot about.
I really like that. Could you repeat that one more time?
Consciousness, in my opinion, and this is my own personal definition, again, based on a bunch of other people's ideas and putting them together, is awareness of yourself and your surroundings in a remembered present. And to answer, get back to your question, I would say that process actually does happen, you know, in your brain. In the brain, there's the mind, which is part of the brain, and then there's other functions that also take place in the brain. But I do think that consciousness is a activity that goes on in the brain, and it's defined as in the way I just did.
Mm-hmm. And there are many different states of consciousness.
Definitely, yes.
In normal, healthy life and in illness.
Yes, certainly. Oh, yes. As doctors, you and I have both seen patients that have been in a coma, and that would be certainly an altered state of consciousness, or coming out of coma, there's various types of levels of consciousness. And there's, you know, people who go on drugs, that's another type of altered state of consciousness. There's sleeping, which is another form of consciousness, and then there's the normal wakeful consciousness that most people experience during their lives, and then meditation is yet another form of state of consciousness.
And there are many other waking states of consciousness that people can experience besides just normal waking and meditation. There's other states that people experience as well. I feel, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Something that brings me back to your definition of consciousness is, and something that I thought was fascinating that you brought up in the book, was the difference between feelings and emotions.
Yes.
So I thought this was very fascinating because, see, I think feelings and emotions, these are a direct product of consciousness, correct?
I would say that they're not necessarily the exact same thing as consciousness.
Has to be conscious to have feelings and emotions.
You do, yeah. These definitions have, you know, interrelated parts.
Yes.
But
how are feelings and emotions different?
Well, you know, that refers to some work that's been done by Antonio Damasio, who's a neuroscientist who's been at various locations. He's now at UCLA. And this is really his idea that there is a difference, his definition that there's a difference between feelings and emotions. And the way he defines it is that emotions are the outward manifestation of a lot of inherited physical and neurologic responses we have to certain stimuli. For example, if you see something that's scary, you will have an emotional response to that where your face will, you know, have a look of startled or worry on it, and your breath will go faster, and your heart will start beating faster, and your blood pressure goes up, and your blood sugar goes up, and all these things are kind of getting ready to either is what's also called the fight or flight response, getting ready to fight or run away and flee. And so that's the inherited emotional response of fear. That's different, according to Damasio, than the actual feeling inside that you sense in your mind and body. So he makes a distinction between the outward manifestation of emotion, which is the first things I was just describing,
more
which
objective.
Other people then can
that
see
can be measured objectively.
And measure,
yes.
And the inward sensation of the feeling of the of what's happening, which no one can ever see or feel except yourself.
Right.
So he calls those feelings, and he says the emotions are the inherited manifestations of these reactions that allow us then to very quickly not only get ourselves in a mode of fight or flight, but also, and not just for fight or flight things. I mean, happiness is an emotion too, of course, and other kinds of pleasant emotions. But his point is that emotions allow us to communicate our sense of where we're at to other people. They're the outward manifestation of these responses. And that then is very beneficial because then we can, without having to say a lot of words or even speak the same language, can communicate to other people and have then the capacity of people to act together to help each other overcome certain problems and life situations. So that's the difference between emotions and feelings.
Of course, you lose a lot of that communication over the phone or over the radio, though you too still maintain some of it by tone of voice and emotion that's expressed in the voice, but you lose almost all of it through email.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is the way most of us communicate.
Yeah.
And so many bad feelings I've seen through email develop because of that loss.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if they were saying the exact same words and you were standing there looking at the person, you'd understand from their body language whether they were joking or whether they were serious or what, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
Interesting. When in your medical career, so you're practicing internist now, you're in private practice?
Yes. Most of my activities are taking care of general medical patients in two different offices in northern San Diego County.
Do you do hospital medicine?
Yes, and I take care of people in the hospital, too.
Okay. And when in your career, right, are you in private practice by yourself?
Yes, I am.
Yes. When in your career did you start to think about incorporating teaching meditation in your medical practice?
Well, very early on, particularly when I saw people that had problems that were obviously stress-related or just generalized anxiety, because I really got disenchanted with the idea that if you give people tranquilizers to treat those symptoms, a lot of those people will get side effects to the medication. There's an expense of the medication, and it doesn't really produce a healthy, totally healthy state of mind. It just kind of helps reduce some of the symptomatology. So to me, meditation was a much better alternative because it was something that was produced a healthy state of mind. It was free, and it had no side effects. And throughout my career, I just have noticed how strong an influence the drug companies have on the way doctors practice. I mean, I prescribe drugs, don't get me wrong. But I really resent the way that drug companies try to really promote that as the main treatment modalities to doctors, and they respond by using that as their main treatment modality. And it's almost hard to go to a meeting that talks about things that don't have a drug treatment with them because the drug companies sponsor so many of these meetings. So it's
absolutely.
It's hard to get out the message that there is a free method of healing yourself, because it's not somebody with a lot of money that has a profit motive to promote that.
Yes. The system, our conventional medical system and its use of medication is very broken right now. It's very broken. It's not a bad tool. I'm very thankful for my prescription pad. I consider my prescription pad sacred medicine when I use it. But I use it understanding the pros and cons and, you know, very cautiously. I can do things with my prescription pad I know no other way to do.
Oh, yeah. I'm not.
But there, of course, there's the benefits that you will get from meditation that you'll never get from a prescription pad.
But, of course, not everybody is willing to take the time and effort to learn to meditate. So for those people, you can't really prescribe meditation
if you're
not willing to try to learn it. But you still want to help those people, too. So we have our other methods of helping those people.
So you accumulated, since you were practicing meditation, teaching it in your practice, then I assume that you, over the years, have paid attention to the research around it that has taken place, and when did you finally decide to put it together in the context of a book?
Well, after I've been teaching a lot of classes, I have two ways of teaching meditation to my patients. One is a direct one-on-one, teaching a meditation class, but that's pretty time-consuming, and,
yes.
In an internal medicine practice, we usually have 15 or 20 minutes to take care of an individual patient on their office visit. That's kind of tough to squeeze that in. So, but I do that for some people who, you know, can't come to a meditation class. But I had been for years now teaching classes in meditation that usually identify somebody who has a stress-related or anxiety kind of problem and say, hey, I think you'd be benefited by learning to meditate. Why don't you come to one of our classes? And then once a week for like 5 or 6 weeks in a row, we'll teach a series of meditation classes to a group of maybe 10 people. Sometimes now I'm going to other wellness centers where I'll have maybe 20. Was at a recent talk where there was 60 people in the audience, but usually it's about 10 people at a time. I'll teach them in my waiting room in an evening session for how to meditate. So that's what I've been doing for a while, for years. And then after I was doing that for a while, I had a whole bunch of notes I was giving people as handouts as part of this effort. And I would as I accumulated more and more of these notes, I realized, hey, these notes could actually be put together in the form of a book. So then I did much more research and put it into a book form. But there is a lot of research on the health benefits of meditation, and I don't know if you'd like to talk a little bit of that now or later.
Yes, please.
And I will say there's three categories of benefits of meditation that are, one is the health benefits, physical benefits, the other is the psychological benefits, and the third is what I was referring to earlier as the benefit of insight. But just focusing on the physical health benefits of it, there's much documentation and randomized, controlled, good clinical studies to show that meditation reduces blood pressure and heart rate, and that was first determined by a cardiologist at Harvard named Herbert Benson, who did good research on this. And then the later research looked at how does that affect patients, and they have looked at now patients who have conditional hypertension, and they find that meditation can lower blood pressure by 5 to 10 points in people with hypertension. They look at people with coronary artery disease. Patients have been looked at, and they find that people who have learned to meditate do better on cardiac stress tests. Congestive heart failure patients also have a greater exercise capacity. People who have heart surgery have less postoperative heart rhythm disturbances. So those are some cardiac effects. Then another group of effects are the immune system. And there's a great group of studies that show how meditation has a positive effect on the immune system. One major study looked at, for example, giving people flu shots. And half the people who took flu shots learned at the same time a meditation technique, which they practiced three times a week, and the other half didn't. They did something else as a control group. And they found that 6 weeks later, the people who were meditating had twice as high a level of infection-fighting influenza antibodies in response to having had a flu shot than the non-meditating group. They also looked at the effects of on the types of white blood cells that fight viral infections most efficiently and fight cancer cells most efficiently. Those are called natural killer white blood cells. And there was a very good study that looked at women with breast cancer, and found that after learning to meditate for 8 weeks, those women would have a 16% increased numbers of natural killer white blood cells. And then when another study later on looked at what was the potency of those natural killer white blood cells, they found that the control group the group that was randomized to the meditation had a 75% increased what's called cytotoxicity, which is the medical word for their capacity to kill invaders or cancer cells, was increased by 75% in the meditating group. And I know you being a OBGYN doctor, may be well aware of some of the research on surgery. And surgery patients, there was one study that was done by Blue Shield that looked at a group of patients undergoing surgery, and they were given half of them were given a guided meditation CD prior to going into surgery preoperatively. And they found that those group of patients recovered from surgery more quickly, caused an average of $2,000 less per surgery, and reported a greater sense of healing. And actually, focusing in on gynecology, there is some very good research on menopause and premenstrual syndrome done out of Harvard, which showed that women who were taught a technique called relaxation response, which is meditating on the word one, there was 103 women in the postmenopausal women who they were found that in the meditation group they were able to reduce symptoms of hot flashes, anxiety, and depression in a randomized control study. And in the premenstrual syndrome group of patients who were studied with meditation, again using relaxation response meditation, after 3 months they found that the women who learned to meditate had diminished lability of mood and anger and decreased anxiety around the time of their periods. And I could go on many other effects, asthma, insomnia, peptic ulcer disease. There's just many effects that have been proven to be positively benefited by learning to meditate, and those are all outlined in my book.
So first of all, as a physician, I'd like to thank you for gathering all that information together in one place. It was very helpful.
Okay.
And putting it in the context of a book that I really like. This is all really amazing stuff. And it really points to the fact, I think, that in our world, in our society, nobody needs to learn how to get stressed out. Everybody does it very well. Everybody's stressed out. People come in and say to me, do you think I'm stressed out? Sometimes they frame it as, do you think I have adrenal fatigue? And I'm like, are you breathing? Do you live on Atlanta's road? Do you drive on Atlanta's roads? Do you have, modern relationships and finances? Do you have a job? Or maybe you don't have it? Hello. The thing we don't know how to do, and we're not taught, and we don't have the common experience of through our life, is deep relaxation and deep quieting.
That researcher I was referring to, Herbert Benson, he had a wonderful comment related to what you just said. He compared the stress response, which is another word for the fight or flight response, to what he was studying in transcendental meditators, and he said that he called what he was finding in terms of the combination of reduced blood pressure and reduced respiratory and heart rate and all as the relaxation response. And then he went on to say that, in his opinion, I totally agree with this, that we've all inherited this relaxation response as a counterbalance to the stress response,
yes,
which we also have inherited. So these are inherited responses, and just like many physiologic systems in our body, they help regulate each other as a kind of a yin and yang counterbalance to each other. The stress response is counterbalanced by the relaxation response. So we all have that within us, and meditation is one of the better ways of tapping into the relaxation response to help reduce the harmful effects of the stress response.
Which is then reflected in many different body systems.
Yes.
In a way that can be documented by good research.
Yes.
That's very clear, not only by the good research that's being done, but if we wanted to, we could also see reflected in many sacred texts in many different traditions over ages.
Yeah, this is something that meditation is something that's actually, we have documentation of, written documentation of meditation that was written about going back 3,500 years ago to the time of yoga meditators.
Yes.
So it's
a document
that that's been around for all those thousands of years that millions of people have benefited from, but we in the West have many of us have never heard about it. But many of the Eastern traditions have, like Buddhism, have focused on it. But it has been around for all that period of time. It stood the test of time because people are still doing it and benefiting from it. And you mentioned Buddhism. I would say that I would do want to tell your listeners that meditation is not any, as you actually said yourself as well, that it's not anything religious. There's nothing, you don't have any type of religious orientation person could benefit from learning to meditate, and it doesn't contradict any of the principles of their religion. And Buddha did not come up with the idea of meditation. He just helped expand it and, frame it in terms of his overall philosophy of life. But meditation is something that has been going on for thousands of years.
I really think that's one of the great contexts and benefits of Dr. Benson's work, is taking and studying it out of the context, in a medical way, out of the context of any particular philosophy or religion.
Yes.
And, identifying it as a relaxation response, it was very important for me. And those years he was doing that work was very, it was like, I love that.
Yeah, it was great to read that when I first started reading his work.
And then
rereading some of his later works, too, where he expands on his ideas as time goes on.
Yes, I agree. So the benefits of having the balance of the deep relaxation. It's interesting when you talk to people about when they're really having the best times of their life and they're really enjoying themselves or really like peak moments, when are your peak moments of their life? Really, when you talk to them, it's always about them being totally in the present.
Yeah.
Something, the experience of life is totally drawing them right into the present. It's so, you know, focusing them so totally on the present that they're not in the past or not in the future, is whether it's a birth or they're out dancing or they're out, you know, whatever it is. It's really bringing them very much into the moment. Meditation we usually think about as a focused practice, somebody sitting down with their legs crossed and meditating. But really, the ability to connect to that state is as present as our breath is.
And that's
every moment of every day.
And that's the concept that also was described in my book of mindfulness. This is the application of how you bring yourself into the present during your normal daily activities. And then so many of your activities become wondrous again. It's like a child again, where you get the light out of just taking a walk, get the light out of just eating good food. So many of our daily activities we can do without thinking, like taking a walk or eating or getting dressed or taking a bath. And most of the time when we're doing those things, our mind is thinking about all the things that are going to be happening later on in the day, or worrying about what's going to happen down the road. Instead of doing that, if we can use a technique to really completely bring ourselves to an awareness of what's happening right now, how wonderful it is, for example, if you're eating, that you can use your hand without thinking to take a spoonful of food and bring it to your mouth in a coordinated fashion and swallow it without choking, and then feel all the wonderful flavors and tastes as you're chewing it and swallowing it. Really getting into the present in those kind of normal activities is really one of the best ways of taking advantage of what's called mindfulness and mindfulness being a form of meditation.
It would be one thing if all the mind chatter was all good and productive, but that's really, occasionally that's the case, but usually not. At least not for me, I'll admit it. Usually it's just, you know, like you say, it's just distracting me and going off and spinning. I've had the benefit and the opportunity and the pleasure of being an osteopathic physician and using my hands with osteopathic manipulative therapy throughout my career. So I do hands-on body work in my practice and always have. The way that has played out over the decades is now when I work on people, it's very much unwinding body work that unwinds tensions in their body and unwinds tensions in their mind, and they enter a very deep state of relaxation after me working on them for 20 minutes or so. Experienced meditators frequently comment is a deep meditative state. And when people who are not familiar with this sit up at the end of the session, they're like, wow, I feel so relaxed. I feel so wonderful. This is like, well, because it invokes a deep relaxation response. And usually what I have to say to them is, yeah, it would be great to have some of that every day, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Not just when you come in to see me. And that leads to the discussion of simple breath meditation, simple relaxation response meditation, that then over the next subsequent sessions I teach them and encourage them to develop
the kind of meditation I like to teach people. Meditation where people can do it on their own at home and don't have to come to a big group of people who are meditating in some sort of regular fashion. That's fine as a reinforcing technique, but in terms of the most benefit is when people can learn to meditate in a simple fashion on their own for 15 or 20 minutes once a day and whenever they happen to want to do it. Because then they can do it regularly, and then they can really get the most benefit out of it.
A little trick that I teach my patients that I'll offer to my listening audience is if you sit in meditation morning and evening, start with it, make it all good and comfortable, make yourself a sacred space to do it. Don't do it for so long that you're uncomfortable. At first, make yourself comfortable, and sit morning and evening to experience that space. And then I tell everybody, I want you to return to that space every time you're waiting during the day. If you're waiting for a red light,
yeah.
If you're waiting on the phone, if you're in the line at the bank, if you're waiting in the doctor's office, we all wait a lot in modern life, every day.
Yeah.
And it's a great
for us sometimes. Instead of letting it become frustrating, it turns into something positive.
Yeah, it's a great tool to teach yourself. It takes a while. Then you're dipping back into that space all through the day.
A red light, when you're driving along, a red light in front of you can become what they call a bell of mindfulness. Instead of a source of frustration, it can remind you to go back to your breath and can get you back into a mindful state, taking something that used to be a negative reinforcer and creating a reminder, what's called a bell of mindfulness, to go back to that state of being in the present and relaxation. The other thing I wanted to, if I could just say that...
We have about 5 minutes left. Please go ahead.
Yeah, the other thing I just wanted to, point I wanted to get around saying was that I do think right now we're in a national debate about health care reform. And, you know, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, I thought had a wonderful statement about that a couple of weeks ago on a talk show where she was saying that our country needs to transform our healthcare system from one that places an overemphasis on mainly treating illness to one that instead starts to place more emphasis on wellness and prevention. And I personally am convinced that if meditation techniques were encouraged to be part of a primary care doctor's normal treatment options and were taught in medical schools, the country could save billions of dollars on less expenditures for prescription drugs, for subspecialty physician consultations, and unnecessary expensive tests like MRI scans and PET CTs and nuclear cardiac stress tests. And in addition to that, not only would the healthcare system would save, you know, a lot of money, people would also feel happier and a sense of wellness at the same time. So there'd now be, the care would cost less, but the people would have a greater quality of life from having used this free treatment. And the startup cost for this kind of a treatment, preventative medicine, is negligible. So I actually have been writing a number of our leaders in Washington about this point, and just got a letter yesterday from Senator Edward Kennedy, who was very much appreciative of getting a copy of the book, is reading it, and was obviously really tuning in to that message that this is one way that we should start talking about how to reform our healthcare system to reduce the demand for expensive tests and thereby lower the cost.
I think that's one of the reasons why the research and presentations of the research, such as your book, is so important. So important. We need more and more research, because we don't need to research for our personal benefit. We don't need the research to learn how to meditate and to see the benefit in our life. We need the research to change the system, because it's all going to be about dollar signs, and it's all going to be about things like that. So we need more and more research to show that there is true cost effectiveness to implementing these practices.
And big time cost effectiveness.
Yeah, big time cost effectiveness. Well, it's going to take something big time to shake the system. So we, as your book comes out, the research that is done, the circle gets a little bit stronger and a little bit wider. It's interesting, you do have really just a beautiful chapter, a really beautiful little introductory chapter on Zen perspective in your book. And it's been interesting to me that there seems to be a big interface between Buddhism and neuroscience to me.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who are collaborating in those two fields.
Yeah, there's been some very interesting interaction between the two fields that I've been following from afar, so to speak. Do you have any contact information you'd like to provide us with?
You can, in terms of how to contact me, you can contact me if you wanted to through my email. It's WeissNest1, that's WEISS. N as in Nancy, EST, so WeissNest, and then the number 1, at Cox, COX, .net.
And also, when you purchase the book, The Healing Power of Meditation by Gabriel Weiss, MD, you get a DVD. Did you have fun recording your DVD? Or your CD?
CD, and it's. I realized, and my publisher realized that you know, it's great to describe meditation in a printed form, but it's sometimes hard for some people to actually read that and then sit down and remember all the instructions while they're closing their eyes and trying to meditate. So we included an audio CD where people can just put the audio CD on and listen, and then practice the meditation while they're just listening to the audio CD, which is often a really good way to learn the technique. And there's several techniques that are on the audio CD, including what I call Aum breath, and something called walking meditation, and Buddha's breathing exercises, and another thing called meditation on the whole person. And we talk about music meditation, too. So the audio CD, I thought, was a nice addition to helping people learn how to do it. You mentioned earlier that when you first start to learn to meditate, it's self-reinforcing, and I totally agree with that. It's, once you begin to do it, you begin to feel better, and so that's the self-reinforcing part. You realize yourself and the experiment of your own life that this is working for you, so you want to do it more and stay with it. And my book closes with this final sentence, which I always try to bring up, which is that the validation of whether meditation works is not in the discussion, but in the practice. And really, when people start to practice it, they will see for themselves that it they'll get their own personal validation that it does help them. If that's something you have to take on faith or belief.
Yes. It's clear, the benefits over time. And when you sit down to do it, when I first started practicing meditation, it was like my relationship to exercise. When I first do it, I sort of have to sit down and make myself do it, you know, and do it. And then it sort of like gets easier. And then at first I had to make myself do it. Then I very quickly enter into a state where I don't want to not do it. I need to do it.
Yes.
I want to do it. Because the benefits start to accrue so much deeper that it becomes very clear. And do we have future creative works from you?
Well, I'm probably will eventually write another book on the general practice of medicine and how I, you know, what I call whole person health care. But that's a future project. Right now, besides my, you know, practice of medicine, I'm actually quite interested in trying to help influence this health care reform efforts that are going on at a statewide national level, because I do see that nobody yet is really, most people are talking about health insurance reform.
Right.
And I think very few people are really focused on how do we lower the demand for expensive tests and treatments beyond just how we finance it.
Right. I don't think health insurance reform is going to do it.
To kind of contact some of the political leaders to try to let them know about these ideas so they can hopefully start to include that as part of the health care reform debate, too.
Yeah, there needs to be more fundamental changes than just payment changes in the system. The system needs to move to a service-oriented system as opposed to a product-oriented system, I think.
Yeah.
To a large degree. This is Temple of Health Radio Show. We've been speaking with Gabriel Weiss and his book, The Healing Power of Meditation. You have sometimes at the end of the show, we'd like to ask our guests if they have a brief inspirational message they could give the audience for a minute.
Well, I would maybe this might be something worthwhile saying. You know, I see that people's life unfolds as a process that unfolds on two levels. The first level is the biological, the physical nature of your existence and the laws that govern the universe. That's the physical dimension. The second level is your worldview, the psychological and physical and philosophical way you view the world. This is the spiritual dimension of your life. And it's possible to use skillful means to forge a harmonious connection between the physical and the spiritual aspects of our lives. And the practice of the meditation is the skillful means we can use to forge that link and bring our lives into a balance. The practice of meditation enhances our happiness, reduces suffering, helps heal illness, and promotes physical well-being. So,
thank you very much.
Summarize the effect of the overall quality on someone's life from learning to meditate.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Kohlfein.
This is Temple of Health Radio. This is Temple of Health Radio Show. Everybody have a great day.